This is lesson number two in a series of eight lessons on the Sermon on the Mount. And the sermon opens with the eight Beatitudes, which just happen to be the best known portion of the Bible. Most people, if they have ever memorized any part of the Bible, have memorized the Beatitudes. And even so, the Beatitudes are among the least well understood statements that come from the Bible. Hardly anyone understands the Beatitudes. And so tonight we're going to begin an experience with the Beatitudes. The reason that we have never understood them is because we have not been able to connect them to our lives. You and I never understand anything that we cannot connect to our own lives, to our own experience. And the reason that we have not been able to connect the Beatitudes to our lives is because we have lacked the spiritual key. So in the beginning, let's see if we can pick up on what I mean by the spiritual key. Epictetus, who was born about the time that Jesus lived, and he was a Roman philosopher, said, "Thou art thyself a fragment torn from God. Thou hast a portion of him within thyself." I think that's a rather remarkable statement for a Roman to have made, but it is a statement that was totally consistent with the message that Jesus the Christ was constantly speaking to us. He was saying that this spirit that God is, we are, and that we will not find him or this spirit until we look for it within our own selves. That was a new way of thinking, because most people until that time, and probably most people until this time, if you'll stop and think about it, have been looking for God in some other place, not knowing that each one of us, is a fragment torn from God. We are individualized expressions of the Spirit of God. The Beatitudes are actually a prose poem in eight verses, which is a complete statement of the teaching of Jesus Christ. And it's more than a statement. You know, if it was just a summary, it would be one thing. But the Beatitudes are actually, they are literally a series of steps that you take, postures that you assume in your consciousness or in your mind. The Beatitudes are not something that you study as much as they are states of mind that you assume, and they are progressive in their movement upward in us. For example, they are like the eightfold path of Buddhism. The ancients, particularly the Eastern philosophers, liked to sum up a teaching, but it was more than a summary. It was, again, an unfolding of the message in a form that could be experienced by a person. The Ten Commandments of Moses were such a grouping of principles. In modern times, the 12 steps to a spiritual awakening of modern-day Alcoholics Anonymous is such a statement. And as a matter of fact, the 12 steps of AA are really taken from the Sermon on the Mount as outlined by Jesus Christ and from certain statements that were in the book of James. And so tonight I want us to not so much think about the three Beatitudes that we will be working with, but to take them, to assume within your own mind, within your own experience, the inner positioning. And you'll notice that there will be a movement in you, a changing, a progressive change in your consciousness. Let me read to you from the 5th chapter of Matthew. And seeing the multitudes, he went upon a mountain, meaning that he moved himself upward in consciousness. And when he was seated, his disciples came to him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, and the first beatitude, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Now, that really doesn't sound to our intellect like a statement upward in consciousness, does it? Well, if you realize that Jesus concerned himself exclusively with the teaching of general principles, of specific principles, and that these specific principles always had to do with mental states, for he knew that if your mental condition was right, everything else must be right too. Whereas if your mental condition was wrong, that nothing else could ever be right. That not until we change how we think and feel can our world change. Unlike most of the other great religious teachers, he never gave any detailed instructions about what we are to do or not to do. He does not talk about what we are to eat or to drink. And he never spoke about carrying out ritual observances at certain times and seasons. Never, ever did he speak of those things. Never. He was talking about principles that needed to be observed or practiced. And they were principles that were applicable to every person who lives on this planet, not just to one specific religious group. His whole teaching was anti-ritualistic and anti-formalist. He said to the people that he was speaking to who were ritualistic at that time, he said, you worship what you do not know, but the hour is coming, and now is when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And he was saying that until we could begin to practice these principles, that religion is not something that you can join. It's something that must be experienced daily. The Pharisees of his day had developed over a period of time more than 650 daily ritualistic things that they had to do. And you can imagine that in order to accomplish all of those 650 things, you would be busy all day long and probably then would not succeed. And not succeeding, how would you feel? How would you feel if you were led to believe that if in order to be accepted by God, that you had to do all of these things? And on a particular day, you only got to 47 of them. Which meant that you had more than 600 to go. Would that cause you to feel spiritually inferior? I probably think it would for most of us. And we would begin to live with a constant sense of being a poor, miserable sinner, which was the exact opposite of what he was trying to teach us to experience. You know that Christianity has duplicated this same state of mind in the last 2,000 years. The message of Jesus was that if we can get things right inside ourselves, in our own minds, in our own spiritual state, that there will be a corresponding change in the world around us. And he was saying, don't put your faith and your trust and your hope in circumstances or in conditions outside yourself. So, let's think of what it means to be poor in spirit, because we're told that those who are poor in spirit will be blessed. As a matter of fact, that they have put themselves, by being poor in spirit, in a position to experience a higher state of consciousness. In the very beginning of this lesson, we have to take into account a point that is really very important, and that is that the Bible is written in a peculiar idiom or language of its own, and its terms and expressions, and sometimes actual words are used not in the sense that we use them in our normal or ordinary language. And the statement, poor in spirit, is not the statement that we would use in our own language. Blessed are those who have surrendered. Comes close to what it means. Blessed are those persons who have come to admit that they are personally powerless. Blessed are those persons who have acknowledged that they of themselves, by themselves, cannot experience, they cannot achieve the things that they wish to experience and to demonstrate in their own lives. Let's take another word that the Bible uses often, because I think it'll give us a better perspective of what poor in spirit really means. Let's take the word bread. In the Bible, the word bread does not mean merely the bread that we take to nourish our physical bodies. Bread means everything that you need at every level of your life. It means such things as clothing, shelter, money, education, companionship. And it also means spiritual perception, insight, discernment, the strength that you need to go out and do the things that need to be done by you, wisdom and understanding. It means guidance. Bread means everything that you can ever possibly need at any moment in your life to achieve the things that you need to do. Prosperity is another word. Prosperity does not mean having lots of things. Prosperity means a state of mind in which one has established their conscious contact with God at such a level that wherever they happen to be at any moment, they're successful in making their demonstration. Prosperity means the ability to demonstrate your bread. If you're prosperous, you have achieved the state of mind that entitles you simply by virtue of being in that state of mind to make your demonstration wherever you are. You'll be at the right place at the right time. You will always have everything that you need at the moment that you need it. And the people that you need to have exist in your life will be drawn to you effortlessly. That's what being prosperous really means. It does not mean one of many possessions, although possessions are an effect. A prosperous person obviously accumulates things. But things are not what make us prosperous. Prosperity is an attitude that supplies us with our bread. So to be poor in spirit does not in the least mean to be poor-spirited. Who wants to be a poor-spirited person, meaning someone without any energy or vitality? A person with an obvious low level of self-esteem. It's not what it means. It means willing to set aside your present habits of thought, your present views and prejudices. It means the person who has become willing to let go of their old ideas. One of the stories that is my favorite that Jesus told was of the rich young man. Remember this young man who had many possessions and who came and said, I would like to join you and your disciples. And Jesus talked to him for a few moments and then sent him back out into his world. And this has often been interpreted as meaning that because he had many possessions, he was not fit to enter into the spiritual life. This isn't what it meant at all. It was not his material possessions. It was what he believed. He was clinging firmly and desperately to his belief system. He believed, for example, that he was a very good person and that it was not necessary for him to change. He had based his identity on what he had, on his possessions and of his relationships, rather than on what he was. And so one of the questions that Jesus asked him had to do with his belief system, and he told Jesus that he really had never made any mistakes. You know of anyone who has made any mistakes? I know some people that cannot admit that they have made a mistake. The rich young man today would be a person that we would say was full of himself. So to be poor in spirit means that we have surrendered ourselves. We are willing to let go of our old ideas. Blessed are those who have surrendered. Blessed are those who have acknowledged that of themselves they cannot make it to the top. Step number two. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, it's fairly obvious that mourning or sorrow is not in itself a good thing. Otherwise, why would Jesus have said that I come so that they might have life and have it more abundantly? And why was it that our instruction from the beginning of the Scriptures to the end was to surrender our suffering, our anger, our fear, our concerns, our worry? So suffering or sorrow of itself is not a good thing. For example, what's the only thing that you can ever learn by hitting yourself on the head with a hammer? Do you know what it is? You're right to stop doing it. The only thing that you can ever learn from suffering is to give it up. And yet, what is the last thing that we're willing to surrender in this lifetime? Do you know what it is? Our suffering. Sometimes we would rather die than to surrender our suffering. We have, and probably the reason is that collectively we are so good at it. We have developed the ability to suffer exquisitely. It has become a science with the human mind, with the human intellect. And so, this beatitude is saying, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Now, it doesn't mean that we'll be comforted because we mourn, but it means that as a result of suffering, the trouble and the tribulation that happens to us, we ultimately will be brought to a place that we are willing to surrender our suffering. Look at your own experience. And I can almost promise you that when you were clinging to a particularly satisfying form of suffering sometime in your life, when you were really had it going good, can you remember the time that I'm talking about? You had it going so well that no one could talk you out of it. There was no comfort in you. Perhaps you wanted someone to come and comfort. But in time, when you got sick and tired of feeling the way that you did and became willing to be changed, almost instantly, comfort comes. Remember? It's astonishing. When we're willing to surrender our suffering, comfort comes. Mourning has as one of its synonyms sorrow, and other synonyms are grief, distress, pain, sadness, woe. Am I reaching any of you? Mourning, regret. Have you ever looked back and were so sorry that you did whatever it was that you did? And in remembering how sorry you were that you had done it, you suffered some more anguish, heartbreak, wretchedness, loss, deprivation, misfortune, affliction, disaster, tribulation, adversity. The good that comes from these things is that they bring us in time to a point in which we are willing to be changed. We're willing to surrender. We're willing to not only let go of our old ideas, which is the first step that we took, but we are willing to be changed. And as a matter of fact, we will go to any length to be changed. We'll do anything. Oh, God, I'll do anything if you will deliver me from this state of mind, sadness, this adversity in which I find myself. It's astonishing what happens when we reach that point of our spiritual unfolding. There's no substitute for suffering. It is absolutely essential in this lifetime. It is the fire that mellows us and ultimately melts us and softens us to the point that we become pliable and willing to be changed. I returned from a trip yesterday and was no sooner in my office than the telephone rang, and the voice that I heard was a man who lives in a distant state, and he said, "You don't know me. You've never met me. You've never heard my name, but I know you. I've been listening to your cassette tapes for more than 3 years." He said, "I think I have heard everything you've ever put on tape. And these 3 years have been the most wonderful years of my life. I've changed. Everyone knows that I have changed. Everyone who knows me is aware of the changes that have taken place." But he said about 3 or 4 months ago, something happened to me, and I can't quite put my finger on it, and I've lost my conscious contact with God. I've lost my confidence and my faith. And I was sitting here trying to get back the thing that has been so valuable to me, and it occurred to me that you might not mind speaking to me if I called you. And I said, "I'm delighted to speak to you. Tell me some more." He said, "I don't know what to tell you. I just started growing, and my life, when I finally got my life where I wanted my life to be, and was enjoying my life in the way that I wanted it to be, this terrible sadness has come upon me." I said, "Could it be that you had defined for yourself a comfort zone and you worked your way into it, and having arrived, the good that you sought then became the enemy of the better that you would seek?" He said, "Well, I'm not sure I know what you're talking about, but I have a feeling for it, so talk to me some more." So I said, you were growing. You grew. And then you stopped growing. Perhaps you forgot that spiritual growth is a process that never ends. It never ceases." He said, "You know, you're right. I feel what you're saying in me." He said, "I want to tell you something, Jack. It's something I've never been able to say to anyone else. I'm scared to death. I'm frightened. But I don't know what I'm frightened of." I said, "Could it be that you are being forced to face your fear, and that your life has brought you to that place now that you, in facing this next phase of your spiritual growth, you will break through the barrier that is confronting you?" And he said, "I really do see what you're talking about. And time does not permit me to share with you the things that happened in his own mind." He came to see that the suffering that he was experiencing one more time had made him willing to pick up on this process of growth, to take the steps of recovery and to go into action. And before he hung up the telephone, he was a changed person. He had recaptured his excitement. He had admitted an area in his life that he had been seeking to avoid. And life will not let us avoid those areas in which we are not comfortable. Do you understand what I'm talking about? It always keeps pushing on us. "Oh, you can rest for a little while. That's all right. But your time will come. And ultimately you will be pushed in the direction that you need to go. And if you will not go there, you will suffer. And so suffering is good. But when you become willing to no longer suffer, and you're willing to be changed, then you will be comforted. And before we hung up, he said, "I feel so good. What you have said has comforted me." But it was not what I said that comforted him. It was his willingness to change that had comforted him. Are you willing to be changed? Now, I know that you have grown along spiritual lines, or you would not be here sharing this evening with me. Dramatic things have happened to you, probably in a very short time. You've had experiences that have gone beyond what you would have imagined in former seasons in your life. Isn't that true? Isn't that wonderful? Do you think that's all there is for you? If you try to settle down into what presently exists, guess what will happen in a short period of time? You know what will happen? More suffering, more woe. Why? Because it's the only thing that will break us loose. It's the only thing that will shock us. Suffering is the only thing that will cause us to take the steps, to take the action, to begin to grow again. And the moment that we begin to grow again, our suffering ceases because it has served its purpose. Blessed is the person who is willing to stop suffering and is willing to grow again. Blessed is the person who is willing to find, to discover, and to experience the lesson that was in the suffering. Suffering is always trying to teach us something. Now, which do we choose, the suffering or the lesson? Most people choose the suffering. Blessed is the person who is willing to look at the anxiety or the worry or the whatever the particular feeling or experience is, and ask to be shown the lesson that is back of it. And if we're willing to experience that lesson, then we're off again on a new season and a wonderful and exciting period of spiritual growth. The third beatitude: blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And on the surface, this beatitude seems to have very little meaning. As a matter of fact, no meaning at all. Because that statement is obviously contradicted by the plain facts of everyday life. A meek person inherit the earth? Never. Of course not. Meek, mousy, inherit the earth? You mean I have to be meek? I'm just going to lie right down on the carpet and let the whole world march right across my back? Why, if I'm meek, just think of the advantages that they, whoever they are, will take of me. Now, either Jesus is a reliable guide or he's not. He knows what he's talking about or he does know what he's talking about. But you see, he knows what he's talking about because he's speaking to us from a state of mind, from a higher state of consciousness, that he wishes to share with us, or to say it better, he wishes to draw us into with him. And when we can understand that that's the spiritual key, that we really are spiritual beings living in a spiritual universe, and that within us, each one, is this Spirit of God that is trying to find its way out into expression. Understanding that fact, then, this beatitude becomes one of the half dozen most important verses in the Bible. And when we possess the true understanding of what it means for us, it will become the key that will unlock the door of any difficulty that we might be experiencing in any moment. Notice that there are two polar words in the text: meek and earth. And that they're both used in a special and highly technical sense. And in order to understand them, though, we have to to unveil the metaphysical meaning. First of all, the word earth in the Bible does not mean the globe on which we reside. It does not mean the earth. It means your earth. It means your world. You live in a world, and you have created your world. Your own world is a combination of all of the facts and circumstances that and conditions that exist for you. Now, your world and my world may overlap, and as a matter of fact, they do. But I live in my world, and you live in your world. We share, each of us, our world with the people around us, the people with whom we live. But your world has been created by you. As a matter of fact, it is the outer manifestation of the state, the true state of your mind. It is a reflection of the totality of your own belief system. The Sermon on the Mount is telling us that all causation is mental or spiritual, and that therefore your body and all of your affairs, your home, your business, everything that makes up your life is but a reflection of your state of mind. And here is this beatitude that's saying that blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. The earth. The Bible talks about possessing the earth, or governing the earth, or making the earth glorious and so forth. It's referring to the conditions of our lives. It means that the meek are those persons who have been given dominion over their lives. If one becomes meek, you will in the process gain control of conditions, circumstances. You'll no longer be the victim of circumstances. As a matter of fact, if we become truly meek, we will become people that will always be in such a state of growth and change and movement that our circumstances will always be altering. We will never live in a static world. Things will always be changing for us, but the changes will be totally satisfactory. They will be the changes that are being dictated by our own choices, our own state of beingness. And meekness is required. Now, the true significance of the word meek in the Bible is a mental attitude for which there is no single word available. There's no word in our language that will convey what meek really means. It's a mental attitude which is the secret of prosperity or success in prayer. Meekness will supply you with your daily bread. Meekness is the realization that the will of God for us is always something joyous and interesting and vital and much better than anything that we could think of for ourselves. Meekness is a state of mind that includes a perfect willingness to allow the will of God to come about in whatever way infinite intelligence considers to be the best, rather than in some particular way that we have chosen for ourselves. Someone who wrote these words anonymously probably understood the meaning of meekness. God does not begin by asking us about our ability, but only about our availability. And if we then prove our dependability, He will increase our capability. Meekness has to do with a deep-set awareness of the importance of change, but not on our own terms. Remember a moment ago when we had decided that we had suffered enough and that we were willing to surrender our mourning and began to be comforted. Then the next step, the next progressive step was to become meek. And this very complex mental attitude means that we are willing to be like Moses. Remember Moses. Moses was born in Egypt, and he was a rich young man in Egypt. Remember, he was the son of the Pharaoh, or so it seemed. And in time, Moses caused himself to be in a lot of trouble and had to leave Egypt. The circumstances under which he left Egypt were not to his liking, but he went out into the desert, and there he created a new world for himself. And he liked his life pretty good. He was living in a comfort zone. He didn't want to change. And one day the Lord God spoke to him and said, "Moses, I have some wonderful news for you." And Moses said, "Okay, God, what is it?" "I have a little trip I want you to take back to Egypt." And Moses spoke those memorable words that you and I have also said, "I won't do it." "You're not going to get me back in Egypt. I've already been there. I'm afraid to go back to Egypt. I'm not going to say that because my ego does not permit me to admit that I'm frightened, but I am. I failed in Egypt. And people in Egypt know me. They've got my number. And you want me to go back to Egypt? No way. I like it over here. I have a new identity where I am, God. And besides, if I went back there, I wouldn't be able to do what you want me to do because I don't have the ability. I don't have the speaking ability. I don't have the power." And the Lord God said, "Moses, you're going to Egypt. You will not grow one inch beyond where you are until you do the thing that you have to do." And so, meekness is the willingness to do the things that we have to do, whether we like them or not. Are you beginning to get the hang of it? Meekness is no longer wanting things on our own terms. Now, does this mean that we stop setting goals? Absolutely not. But we say this or something better. And I hope that it's going to be something better because I really don't know what I want. I really don't know what I need. But I'm willing to go into action to have the experiences in life that are mine to have. Well, you know what happened to Moses. He went into Egypt and the Lord God was with him. Because God can only be with those persons who are willing to be changed, who are willing to do the things that they need to do. Select any day in your life, any time, any season in your life when you were ready to move into that day filled with enthusiasm and prepared to do the things that were yours to do, and asking for God's guidance and help. Were those days not the most glorious days of your life? And did you not always find that you had the strength that you needed when you needed it? That you were at the right place at the right time? In those seasons in your life, have you ever really been defeated? Never. Ever. You can look back upon those times and they are the sweetest days and weeks and months and years of our lives. When we were meek, open, and when we had opened up every part of our lives, of ourselves, to growth and to change. That's what meekness really means, that in that state of mind, we inherit the earth. It means that we have taken charge of our lives again, but not we ourselves. There's a partnership that takes place. There's a relationship that develops. Something happens. We become empowered and inspired and motivated. to become poor in spirit, and then to surrender our suffering, and to become meek, meaning open to change, no longer resisting, no longer holding back, means that we will be experiencing the presence of God. Erich Fromm said, man's task in life is precisely the paradoxical one of realizing his individuality and at the same time transcending it and arriving at the experience of universality. Only the fully developed individual self can drop the ego. To become willing to be changed is a startling experience. And in the first movement of that change, we make the changes that need to be made for ourselves alone. Oh God, change me. Make me over into the person that I was destined to be. And as this process continues, real meekness then takes place. True meekness is when we begin to share what is happening to us with other people. Oh, in the first season of our growth, it is for us. It has to be. But in time, unless we begin to give of ourselves to other persons, unless you become more important to me than me, I will lose my meekness and I will lose my growth. A truly meek person is one who lives for other persons. And yet the paradox is that you cannot live for other persons without living for yourself. Meekness means that we've reached the stage that everything that we have is to be shared with other persons, including our material possessions. It means that we're willing to give of ourselves, including tithing, holding nothing back. We would not hold anything back because we've come to know that if we hold anything back, we're holding back our own growth. That we can only have what we share. We can only have what we give away. And therefore, we must be constantly giving ourselves away, sharing our experience, our strength, our hope with other persons. Meekness means that we come to know that we are all brothers and sisters. We're all part of one spirit and that I of myself am nothing. Of course, I must have you, I must have like-minded persons in my life supporting me, but that is a selfish kind of meekness. Real meekness is when we come to really understand that I must have you in my life so that I can support you and help you and strengthen you. And that it really is for me. It's for you, but it is for me. That we are one, the fellowship of the Spirit. That we really are one with God. And that this life that we're living together on this planet is not static. It is dynamic. That together we have the ability, you and I, together, bring about the most incredible changes in ourselves. But you cannot do it by yourself. And I cannot do it by myself. But together, there's nothing that's impossible for us. Do you believe that? I know it's true. Blessed are the poor in spirit. For they are very close to something that is greater than themselves. Blessed are those who have mourned but who are willing to surrender their suffering because instantly their comfort will come. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who are willing to be changed, who are pliable and moldable, whose excitement now lies not in holding on, but in releasing and letting go, and in sharing and giving. For they shall inherit all the good that God can bestow upon them. And that's the way it really is.